Well, it's a sort of public lecture book launch event where we're going to hear, I should say first, the hashtag for the event is hashtag Elsie Varzi, because we are going to hear from Saida Varzi, Baroness Varzi, who has written a book called The Enemy Within, A Tale of Muslim Britain. And the title itself, I think, gives you an important sense of why this is an interesting subject from a parliamentarian as an experience of a particular aspect of being in British public life. Very unusual. We're just discussing this on the way in the lift. We're here in the lift. Saida Varzi is Britain's first Muslim cabinet minister, is also a lawyer, business person, and a racial justice campaigner. Appointed a life peer at the age of 36, she served as chairman of the Conservative Party in the Foreign Commonwealth Office and as Minister for Faith and Communities. And in the summer of 2014, she resigned from the government on the grounds of the government's policy on Gaza. So what we're going to do this evening is to hear from Baroness Varzi for perhaps 20 minutes, and then I'll ask one or two questions, and then we'll open it up for a broader discussion till about 7:30, partly because the train has to be caught at 8:30, and then there'll be an opportunity to buy a copy of the book outside, should you wish to, and I'd encourage you to do so. Anyway, I'll pass over to you.
Do you want me to come there or here?
Yeah, whichever you feel more
comfortable. I'll come up there and then I'll come back. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much, Tony. I want to really take the conversation today wherever you want to take it. I'm now, saying to Tony, it's event 22 since the book has come out. And I always find that the best part of these evenings are really when you start asking me questions that you really want to ask about. But there's one rule to tonight, and that is that there are no rules. There is no question which is off limits. There is nothing that you're going to ask which probably hasn't been asked before. And there is nothing that you're going to ask a working class Yorkshire defence lawyer that is going to offend me. So therefore, ask me whatever you want once we get into the Q&A session. I want to start really in these opening remarks to talk about a bit about myself, who I am, what my journey was, how I got to be here. And secondly, why I wrote the book. So my name's Saida Varzi, born in 1971. It makes me 47 in a few weeks' time. I'm the second of five girls. I was born and raised in a working-class Yorkshire family, a family that originated from Pakistan. My grandfather came here in the 1950s. This year, we're about 60 years in country. I would describe it as a typical Pakistani Muslim household, a fairly conservative household, and a household which was made up of all women, made our upbringing quite unique in many ways. Parents who didn't go to university, but who were very ambitious for us, had a very clear sense that we had to achieve something. The biggest mantra that we heard from my mum as we were growing up was that we had to be better than the boys. So we grew up with a big chip on our shoulders. And like most Asian mothers, and you know, you young people may find that you have challenges sometimes with your parents. Well, Asian women of my generation had mothers who chose both their careers and their husbands, which my mum Julie went on to do. She told me that I had a choice of being a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant, an engineer. You've probably heard the drill at home if you're from an Asian family. I got law. I can't do blood. Also, I didn't realize I was going to enter the biggest blood sport ever in politics. But the different kind of blood. I went on to study law, specialized in criminal defense, ended up working for the Crown Prosecution Service and then into defense work. I spent most of my 20s, really, and teenage years being involved in student union politics, but being radicalized, and I do use that word, being radicalized by race. What I felt society had an issue with at that point was the color of my skin. Many people of my generation defined themselves as black. Whether you were black, you were black. If you were white, you were black. If you were Asian, you were black. If you were gay, you were black. If you're female, you're black. It was a way of kind of convalescing around what we thought was the big issue of the day. I uniquely remember Nelson Mandela being released from Robben Island, what was happening in the US, and of course the riots that happened in this country as well. Religion was something we practiced at home and we kept it there and wasn't really part of our public life in any way. But then when people say that a single event can really change the course of your life, for me it was September the 11th. It stopped me being black and Asian, or black and British, or British and Asian, but it suddenly made me British and Muslim. And all those issues that I thought we had got over and fought and won, and managed to start to have quite a successful story of integration, were challenges that we were going to face all over again. I left the United Kingdom. I had a legal practice at the time. I sold it. And I left the United Kingdom in 2002, about 8 months after September the 11th happened. And I went to the only other place where I thought I could go and find myself in this early midlife crisis, and that was Pakistan, the place where my parents had originated from, a country that I didn't know. I wasn't born there, I wasn't raised there, but I somehow felt that there was something that I would be able to find out about myself if I was to go there. Now, for the record, because I know that universities all now have a prevent duty, that was not my jihadi gap year. There were moments when I was in Abbottabad, and I was probably in the same cities that Osama bin Laden was there, but we never met, for the record. Having spent about 7-8 months out of the country, having realized that in many ways I had been a coward. I had decided not to fight the good fight when I realized that there was a sense of unease between my country and my faith, and that if I really wanted to make a difference and create some sense of understanding, that I should have played my part. So I came back in 2003. In 2004, I was being terribly opinionated in a Conservative Party conference, and I was talent spotted. I was asked to stand in 2004. I was selected, stood in 2005 in my hometown, and I could give you a whole lecture on what happened during that election. But interestingly, it was the year where the British National Party had polled the most number of votes anywhere in the country, in the constituency in which I stood in West Yorkshire. I didn't win that election in 2005, but I worked alongside Michael Howard during that election. And after that election, he introduced me to a young man whose campaign he asked me to become involved in. That young man was called one David Cameron. You may remember him. So David and I worked together on his selection campaign. He ended up becoming leader of the Conservative Party. And a few years later, he asked me to join his shadow cabinet. And in doing so, because I wasn't in the House of Commons, he asked me to join the House of Commons, which at the age of 36 was quite an unusual appointment. The average age in the House of Lords is 69. There are a couple of handful of us that are born after 1969. So the downside was I was in a very old house. The upside was that 12 months after being in the House of Lords, I won this amazing accolade of being the sexiest member of the House of Lords. In the middle of my career, I had my own teeth. I had an advantage. So having done that, we went on to fight the election in 2010. You will remember we formed the coalition government. David asked me to become chairman of the party, which I did for 2.5 years, and then went on to serve as William's deputy in the Foreign Office. And then, as Tony mentioned in the introduction, in 2014, whilst I was at the Foreign Office, I was the minister for the UN, for the ICC, for human rights, and I was a spokesperson in the House of Lords, and in the middle of the Gaza conflict, I felt that I could no longer continue to support government policy, and I resigned. Life after that, I'm now Pro Vice Chancellor of a university, visiting professor at St. Mary's, got to write this amazing book, back in business, became a grandma, all the wonderful things that you can do when you're no longer in government. Why did I write the book? Because when I was in government, you may recall that in 2012 there was a terrorist attack in London when a soldier was killed on our streets, Drummer Lee Rigby. And after Drummer Lee Rigby was murdered, we set up a task force to look at ways in which we could have avoided that incident, or avoided such an incident happening in the future. And I used to sit on the National Security Council as well. And a right-wing commentator wrote a piece in which he said, how can we deal with the war on terror when we have her, Baroness Varsi, the enemy at the table? Now, I'm used to my fair share of insults. I hope you're not offended by this term, but it's a term that I grew up with. And certainly I was of the era where paki bashing was a norm. You ran like mad after school because you knew there were certain times of the year when you would get your head kicked in. And so, therefore, I'd been in police stations and prison cells whilst all sorts of obscenities had been said and people had called me names. But what that insult did in 2012, as I sat around that cabinet table, was it said to me that despite the fact that both your grandfathers, your paternal and maternal grandfathers, served in the British Indian Army, were prepared to give their blood for this country, despite the fact that your father came to this country and they, you know, your parents broke their backs in the mill towns of Yorkshire to create a life for themselves and a living for themselves and a life for others as well, and despite the fact that you have served your country at the top table in the land, you don't belong. We don't trust you. And I always think that the best way of dealing with an insult is to field it well. And so, therefore, this book was my way of owning the insult, fielding it well, and proving that term, the enemy within, to be the bullshit that it is. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Well, admirably succinct. Can I just pick up on the very point you made at the end there? That is that in any society, there will always be a suspicion of the other, people who've just arrived or people who are thought to have just arrived, which I realise is your grandparents and all of that, not really just arrived. But there's always the fear of the other and those who particularly people not used to. I mean, after time, if you look at where, you know, the BNP used to get its vote in cities, they're almost predictors of where that kind of politics has no space today. I mean, it's a phase, the reaction to the other. But the truth is, Britain is now a country of migration, mass migration in recent years. I mean, starting in 1948 in waves since then, but a substantial amount. And big cities in the north, the Midlands and London now have very large populations of migrants, some of whom are non-white and Muslim, some of whom are white and Christian. So it's a more complex issue even than it was 20 years ago. But with that as a background, I mean, how would you say to one of the people who treated you in the way you've described just now being treated, how would you try to convince them that they were wrong? What would you, I mean, you must have done this, don't get me wrong, but what is it you'd say to them about their view, which we all have to respect each other's views in a democracy, apart from the obscene stuff and the bad stuff, but how would you convince them that they were wrong?
I think there are two ways in which you deal with this. You will always have people who are at the bottom of the pile in society, who haven't done well in their life, who feel that they need a scapegoat for the woes in their own life. And whilst I would never excuse that, I can at least try and understand that feeling. So, the street thug who turns around and calls you a paki and tells you, effing so-and-so, you kind of think, well, okay, maybe that's what you understand. That's all you understand. And I can kind of, almost expect that from you. I think what concerned me about this particular insult was that it was from, a very respectable writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say that, when the respectable rationalise bigotry, that's when it's most dangerous. When it's on a Friday night, when somebody's had a bit to drink, it's violent and it's immediate. But where it's most pervasive and dangerous, I think, is where the think tank, or the politician, or the newspaper editor, or the journalist, under the cover of respectable professional background, decides to say this stuff. Because that kind of nudge-nudge, wink-wink approach towards policymaking saying, you see, what that writer was saying, and this writer is now an executive director of a think tank, He engages, and the think tank engages regularly with ministers and with parliamentarians, are quoted by the mainstream press. So this is not just, you know, your thug on the street. I think that is a really difficult place to be, and that's why part of this book, and the whole kind of part two of this book, which is called The Errors of the Past, logs how Islamophobia and anti-Muslim hatred and bigotry became respectable. And there's a whole section in here called The Paranoid State, in the way in which kind of state levers have been used to kind of reinforce some of this othering. And then there's a chapter in here called The Seven Sins of Islamophobia, the ways in which the respectable rationalise that bigotry, where people will say, I'm not Islamophobic, but... And then they give you all these reasons. And so I've gone through every single but and unpicked the but. So how do we deal with it? Well, first of all, hopefully through intellectual argument. I mean, that's why this book, amongst other things, has 100 pages of citations. Because one of the hardest arguments to win with somebody, you know, if all you're saying is this is my view and that's somebody else's view, it's just a series of polemics.
Sure.
So I think for me, I had to go back to being the lawyer in me. I had to show the evidence. I had to show the data. I had to unpick the way in which policymaking was fundamentally different when it came to British Muslim communities on a certain issue. And I kind of give very real examples of that. So how do you deal with it? I think by consistently fighting back against the climate that it's been created. Only 2 weeks ago, I gave evidence before the Home Affairs Select Committee. In 2011... I did this speech in which said Islamophobia had passed the dinner table test. And, you know, people got very vexed about it. It's such a timid statement in retrospect. And when I gave evidence, and when I said that in 2011, one of the strongest arguments that was put against me was, oh, don't be so stupid, it doesn't even exist. So I had to start from a point of saying, well, okay, let's go out and get the data to show it exists before I then say, and it's wrong. And the Home Affairs Select Committee said to me, you know, you said Islamophobia passed the dinner table test. What would you say now? And I said, well, I think Islamophobia is Britain's bigotry blind spot. Right. We fail to see it when it's staring at us in the face. And I think, therefore, we have to consistently push back against the climate of othering that is created. And that requires, you know, academic institutions to do that, the press to be properly... kind of scrutinised and regulated, the, you know, policy making to be based on evidence, not upon, you know, what looks great in a Daily Mail headline.
But for the state, I mean, the reason that the journalist made the remark is that the state, the British state, was trying to use your talents, I'm guessing, they were trying to use your talents, and trying to, and the state finds it very difficult, does it not, to come to terms with new sort of challenges to the normal way, the traditional way of doing things in a country and the way of thinking in a country, where suddenly it's challenged by people who are different and have different religion or values or whatever it is. And the state, I think, well, question is a question, do you find that when you were working in government that the rest of your colleagues found it hard to understand how to come to terms with the difference that they, at some level, wanted to use you to help them to understand? Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. You were given roles in government that showed that David Cameron understood he needed to have somebody who could represent a Muslim point of view, let us say, or somebody from a minority and a Muslim point of view, and yet you're sort of saying, and I think it must be true, the establishment finds it hard to adapt quickly to these things. Is that...
I suppose where I disagree with you is a number of things. First of all, the Muslim community is not new.
No, and
one of the things I talk about in this book is the Muslims have been coming since the 7th century, right? So it's been a pretty long time. Long before they came here, we went there. So we've known Indian and Pakistani and Bangladeshi Muslims for at least a couple of hundred years before they came here. And so in that sense, you know, we're either really stupid or we can't read history books. And so, for me, I refuse to accept in a super-connected, globalized world as ex-colonizers that we do not get the world. I mean, the one thing that we do get in Britain is we get the world, or we should at least get the world. And so, therefore, if we choose not to understand a community, that's because we're choosing not to understand a community. Secondly, I suppose where I struggled was occasionally political parties like to bring people forward who I think represent the fact that that party has changed, or this is a new face, or this is a new phase within a political party. But there is no point being at the table without a voice. And if political parties and politicians find a new face with a voice too difficult, then that new face shouldn't have been there. And one of the things I talk about, I mean, it's International Women's Day today, and one of the things I talk about is that there's a big difference between women as instruments of policy and women as policy makers. There's a big difference between women being in positions of power and women having power to exercise. And I think probably where I probably struggled occasionally with my colleagues was, you know, yes, I think in many ways I was the perfect brown-eyed girl, you know, I represented a good northern, strong, working class, ethnic minority, Muslim, whatever kind of image of where the party was going. But I also had a mind and a brain to be able to say, well, look, this is what I think my views are. What I found, I suppose, disturbing in this policymaking within government, and I talk about it in the book, is that much of the policymaking around counterterrorism and counter-extremism, which is one of the issues that we were concerned about, is not actually based on fact. So if we take, for example, the drivers of radicalization, by any standard, whether you take the Intelligence Services Behavioral Sciences Unit, or whether you take academic research, or if you look at those people who, if you look at the work of those people who have studied the lives of terrorists, there are anything between about 14 to about 28 different telltale signs that somebody's about to become a violent extremist, somebody's about to become a terrorist. And of those telltale signs, 14 to 27, I mean, hands up, how many do you think government focuses on?
One.
So I'm sat there thinking, okay, well, this one issue is important, but what about these 20-odd other issues? And if we're not, and if because the one is convenient policymaking, so be it. But the whole point of us making, you know, forgive me for wanting evidence, but surely as politicians we should be looking back and say, well, what are, you know, when we look at the lives of a terrorist, what are the telltale signs that are prevalent in most of them? And I just found that that wasn't happening.
And, you know, politicians pride themselves, all parties, of wanting to be, you know, evidence-based policy they talk about. We want evidence-based policy. But you're effectively saying that there's one aspect of this issue that we're going to choose because it's easy or because it's the one we recognise or something. But how did you go about convincing your colleagues that there was more than one of these signs? Or how would the machinery deal with that? How would it find that out if it hadn't chosen to research it?
I think that there were certain very loud voices on this issue who considered themselves to be authoritative.
Right.
And I don't really want to name names, but certainly there was there was one individual within Cabinet who thought he was a real expert on this issue. And what fascinated me was that this gentleman had never travelled to majority Muslim countries. He didn't like flying. I remember having a conversation once about this around the table and saying, have you ever been to a mosque? And I think the answer was, yes, I've been once. I remember thinking, he doesn't go to mosques, he doesn't know many Muslims, and yet he's got no academic background on this issue, but yet there's a narrative that he's put out which has now become the authoritative version of how you deal with this. And unfortunately, I think, you know, people are influenced by people they get on with and they're friends with, and unfortunately, once that narrative had taken hold within government, it became quite difficult to be able to unlock. So one of the things that I do in this book is I go back through David Cameron's journey on this, and I go back to the speeches that he was giving in 2005 and 6 and 7, and the speeches that he was subsequently giving in 14, 15, 16. So I say in his own words, forget what I think, but look at where, because occasionally, you know, one of the questions I get asked, Tony, is, you know, when did the love affair with the Tory party end? You know, what happened? You know, how did you suddenly kind of get to the point where you couldn't agree with such fundamental issues? And I said, no, it wasn't me that changed. They changed.
Yeah.
David changed. And if you look at the speeches that, you know, he was talking, you know, when I was kind of involved in his campaign and all of the work we were doing in 2005, 6, 7, and where he ended up, I was still at 5, 6, 7 saying this is really the right way of dealing with it. But, you know, when your party shifts in one direction, it's sometimes, and there's a big momentum to take it there, and we can see that, you know, with political parties now, left or right, you know, if you get pulled to the left or pulled to the right, it's really hard for those of us in the centre ground to try and keep that party back in that rational space of evidence-based decision making.
Now, just one sort of personal question. Given that the majority, I think the data on this, the majority of Muslim voters, Muslims in Britain who have registered to vote, don't vote Conservative, right? I think that's right, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
What led you to the Conservative Party as opposed to the Labour Party or another party?
Well, the majority of British Muslims are Conservative, small c.
True.
And what should be worrying my party is that why are the majority of British Muslims not voting Conservative? Which was why I became involved, to say, well, this is instinctive, a kind of support for family values, hard work, entrepreneurship, you know, kind of small state approach, civil individual liberty, everything about, you know, kind of pushing parents, the whole thing of the way in which the community has lived its life is absolutely focused on very clear conservative values. So what is it about our brand that is so bad and toxic that
we can say it's the brand?
So basically, so we did
some of the
surveys.
Other members.
No, we did this. We did a survey in which we basically said, "Do you agree with these principles and policies?" And they went, "Oh yeah." Well, what if we told you they were conservative? I can't vote for the Conservative Party. So even when they would agree with policies and principles of conservatism, they couldn't vote for the party because there was a brand. And some of it was really old. So they were, you know, people would still quote you, Enoch Powell, Rivers of Blood. Mm. You guys are racist. You used to have the primary purpose test. You used to engage in virginity testing at airports. All of that stuff would come back at you, depending on what everybody's personal experience had been of the party over the years. And look, there's no doubt that there has been, and I track some of this, you know, in all political parties, there have been moments of awful racism within political parties where we have said and done and behaved in a way which is unacceptable. So I think some of it was historic, some of it was brand, but under David Cameron, and if you look at that 2010 election, there was an increase in the number of ethnic minorities and even Muslim communities that were voting for the Conservative Party. That was, again, quite strong, but not as strong in 2015, and then it fell away in 2017. So we're now going backwards again across all ethnic minority communities. So I think it definitely is a brand issue, and it's also an issue around sincerity. I think people question whether they can trust the Conservative Party on these issues. And a colleague of mine and I were talking about this recently, to say, look, if you've never been to the Notting Hill Festival and send, you know, as Tory MP, you toddle along, well, first year, they're going to think, what the hell is that idiot here for? Second year, they're going to think, well, the idiot's back. Third year, that idiot keeps coming. Fourth year, they might actually talk to you. Fifth year, they think you're part of the, you know, course. Sixth year, when somebody turns around and says, there's a bloody Tory who's turned up at the festival, somebody will turn around and say, leave them alone, they've been coming for years. It takes time to build trust, and it has to be done from a position of authenticity and sincerity. So we can't just do it for a year and then hope everybody forgets about what we've done in the past.
Well, and I'm going to turn it to the audience next. One final question, though. As a politician in the United Kingdom, in a sense, if you go into politics, most people go into politics because they've got particular objectives and they want some, you know, either go into the Commons or the Lords. They are an MP, Member of Parliament, both at one house or the other. But in your case, and a number of non-white and non-Christian type MPs, they find themselves representing not only the thing everybody else represents, but in a sense they become representative of Muslims, or indeed, and in both ways potentially, having to do two things. So it's one level, as it were, being seen in the government, in your case, as being a Muslim in the government, and understanding and presumably giving the government some credibility and all of that, but representing it in some way, representing the religion, and then arguably also representing government to Muslims in your home city. Is that a fair description of what it's like?
Slightly, not completely. So I would basically say, I'm surprised that I ended up doing the jobs that I ended up doing.
Right.
Because I came from a criminal justice background, I came from a business background, I probably should have been doing a justice job, or I should have been doing a biz job. And so why I found myself doing faith and communities or foreign office stuff or whatever I ended up having to do was a little bit odd, but you kind of just got on with it. Although the chairman's job was a completely non-ethnic, non-gender, non-role. So there were certain jobs that I did in government which were kind of slightly unusual. But I think that, you know, when as a young person, you know, as a teenager, lots of Asian people in my, you know, lots of Asian people of my generation had double lives. So we had our little Asian life at home, and then we had a little non-Asian life outside. And then as you get a bit older, you kind of think, well, I want a little bit of my non-Asian world to know about my Asian world, and I want my little Asian world to know about my non-Asian world. And then you get a bit older, and then you think, you know what, to hell with you. I want you all to just accept me for who I am. And I'm sick of this kind of trying to fit in with everybody. And I suppose it's part of growing up. And when I came into politics, I was at that stage where I was very sure of who I was. And I heard lots of ethnic minority, and in fact female politicians saying, oh, I don't do women's things, or I don't do ethnic minority things. And I think they kind of felt they had to do that to stop themselves being pigeonholed. Yeah. But I also felt that when I'm walking through a door, it's fairly obvious. And if there's a discussion going on about which I have real expertise, because I've lived this life for 40-odd years, then surely I have a responsibility to put some of that honesty and authenticity and real-life experience on the table. And so I think I never made any secrets of who I was, and I never shied away from what my identity was. But I suppose in doing so, I think you are right, you do start to become pigeonholed in a certain way, and you're held accountable. So yeah, I would say it the other way around. I spent half my life fighting the British Muslim community in government, and the other half fighting the government. And trying to kind of find a middle way where both of them would be able to understand each other a little bit better.
Okay, great. Well, look, questions, thoughts? Feel free. Good, right. One here, one there. So we'll take them three together.
Yep. Hi, first of all, thank you. It's really interesting, particularly on International Women's Day. Great to hear from you. I was wondering what you thought about Sarah Champion and her approach to the Rotherham sex gang and how she characterised it as a Pakistani men problem.
Okay, and chap here, and then...
Hi, following on from your comment about double lives, post 9/11, post 7/7, there was often this question of, is it possible to be both British and Muslim? And that question was posed by non-Muslims as well as Muslims. How much, if at all, do you think we've progressed from that question?
Okay, good short question. I'll take three. I promise everybody else will get one, so I'll take the third there. So I'll just see, otherwise we'll get too many questions, it'll be hard to remember them. So go for the third, and I'll come back to you two. Yeah.
Thank you for being here. I'm not very familiar with the discourse of Conservative and Labour parties, but I was wondering, when you were talking about branding, do you think that the Conservative Party... wants to appeal to Muslim Britain and minorities, or it's targeting a different audience? And do you think it wants to change its branding? Thank you.
So if I take them in the order that they were asked, yeah. First of all, the Sarah Champion question. It's a really important question, and there are, I suppose, a number of bits to it. First of all, there's the issue of grooming and paedophilia and the abuse of children. And I think, again, going back to evidence, statistically, if you went through, I mean, if you, in this country, if most paedophiles are likely to be middle-aged white men, that's a fact. But this particular form of grooming, which was street grooming in the nighttime economy, was, as you saw the arrests coming through, was predominantly men who worked in that nighttime economy, i.e. taxi drivers and takeaway owners. And I therefore... there was the vulnerability. If you wanted a ride home and you didn't have the money, if you wanted a kebab or a burger at the end of the night and you didn't have the money, if you came into these takeaways and there was nobody looking out for you, then these girls were vulnerable. Those men took advantage of that vulnerability, and that's where the street grooming took place. So I think there is definitely, it's definitely right to say factually, most paedophiles are middle-aged white men, but most men involved in street grooming around this nighttime economy, this specific form of grooming, is actually predominantly men who work in that nighttime economy who happen to be men from Asian backgrounds, predominantly Pakistani, Bengali, and Turkish backgrounds. And I think, therefore, that should have been had. That debate should have been had. And in fact, I was having it back in when these first cases first started to emerge. But I think the statement that she made was that, you know, something about Pakistani men are groomers or whatever. Actually, you probably know what she said. What did she say?
Pakistani men rape white girls.
Pakistani men rape white girls, I think was the the headline that was used in the thing. Well, actually, sadly, men rape girls. Let's start with that. Men rape, you know, women, and men rape men as well, actually, tragically. And but to say that, I mean, my father's a British Pakistani man, my husband's a British Pakistani man, my son's a British Pakistani man. You know, to try and vilify a whole community in that way is this, again, this kind of lack of evidence-based decision-making. And I think if what she had said is what I'd said, which is there's this particular kind of grooming, which the second question then follows on from that, and there was a report on this recently to say, what motivates men to do this? Is it something about their Pakistani culture? Is it something to do with their religious background? Is there something instinctively, in terms of their identity, that makes them groomers? Well, I think that people who abuse children or abuse women do it because they have a position of power. So whether you're a Hollywood director and you've got a young actress who walks in and you want to use your power over her, whether you're a minister or somebody in politics and a young intern comes in for a job and you feel you can do that, whether you're a celebrity and you know you're working in children's homes and you use that as an opportunity, wherever there is a power imbalance, where there is somebody in a position of power and some element of vulnerability, that can be used. Whether you're in the Church of England and you're a priest and you've got children who you're working with you, or whether you're working in a takeaway or you're a taxi owner and somebody wants a free ride home, or you give somebody a ride home, or they're in care and you think there's nobody looking out for them, so therefore you can. Anywhere people think they can get away with it, they will get away with it. And we saw that recently, tragically with Haiti, where we saw some of our most respected charities, people who are supposed to be aid workers, getting involved in this kind of behaviour. So I think it's really important that we have the discussion around the concept of vulnerability and power and how power is used to abuse people, rather than, because the minute we say, oh, it's Pakistani men on white girls, actually we take away all the men who might not be Pakistani, and we take away all the girls who may not be white. And what's coming out again now, when as the evidence emerges, is that these men were also grooming and abusing non-white girls, so Asian girls. And in many ways, the Asian girl victims are the ones that have been the least heard about, because they're the least likely to come forward because of the additional challenges that they have, that they feel that they're going to be stigmatised for actually bringing these issues forward. So I think Sarah Champion, unfortunately, in a city like Rotherham, you know, grabbed a quick headline, and I just hope she'd be much more sensible around what I think is a really important debate, which we should have engaged in as grown-ups. Second question, are you British or Muslim? Oh, God, the number of times I've been asked this question. Are you British or Muslim? It comes alongside how many times a day do you pray, and what do you think of the hijab? I mean, it's like every interview this question used to come up when I was in government. And how can you even answer that question? I mean, what do you do? Wake up in the morning and think, oh, I'll be British today. Oh, it's Friday, I'll be Muslim today. I mean, you don't, people don't kind, when you walk down the street, you have so many identities. You have a young person's identity. You have a, you know, a person that, with what you've got on, your brand of jeans identity, whether you're with a girl or a boy identity, which institution you're studying at identity, which T-shirt you've got on. You know, are you a mother? Are you a daughter? We have so many identities. People say to me, what's your most overriding identity? I say, probably being from Yorkshire. It's the one thing that permeates throughout everything, kind of that no-nonsense, outspoken, you know, approach to life actually probably comes from being Yorkshire. So I feel it's a really false way, because what's usually in that question is an underlying saying of, where do your loyalties lie? Well, I don't know. It just depends on what I feel like that day. You know, and I think there's, you can't, it goes back to the old-fashioned normative cricket test. You know, who do you support at cricket? And depending on who you support at cricket determines whether or not you're loyal to a nation. So I think it's a really divisive question. Is it possible to be British and Muslim? Well, yeah, absolutely. Why is it possible to be British and Christian? Why is there no conflict there? I mean, unless I've got my history wrong, you know, Jesus wasn't born in Leeds. And Moses wasn't born in Manchester, so Muhammad wasn't born in Leicester. So what? Get over it. They all came from the same lands. If their religions all came over here, and it's all right to be British and Christian and British and Jewish, and British, so why is British and Muslim so unusual? You know, none of these are indigenous faiths to Britain. They all came in at some point. I mean, Cheddar Man was what? Black with blue eyes. So I just think we just need to get over it a little bit and just kind of understand that we are a nation. Sorry? It was an illegal immigrant, exactly. There's this fantastic, I talk about it in here actually, there's this fantastic comedy sketch on YouTube which you've got to look up, which is Paul Nuttall, they're coming over here. And it's just such a fantastic thing, or when he starts off with, those Eastern Europeans bloody coming over here, taking our jobs, and eventually he kind of ends up, that bloody amoeba climbing out of the sea, trying to multiply its cells, coming over here, and it really goes back to how far do you go? You know, through history, we're all kind of comers in at some point. So I think you're just going to be, you know, I say to a lot of young British Muslims, you're just going to be proud of yourself. You're just going to say, this is who I am. And actually, at times, people have had a problem with people, but we're going to work it out. We had, I was in the House of Lords this morning, and I was listening to a conversation between the Archbishop of Canterbury and Jonathan Sacks, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. And it was an in conversation with a few parliamentarians invited to kind of take part. And Jonathan Sacks said, you know, what they're saying about the Muslims now was only what they were saying about the Jews 100 years ago. It's only a question of time. And he said, you know, I feel quite confident we'll work it through. You know, we've been through this and we'll come out of it again. So I think you have to kind of have some faith in history.
Sorry, if I may inject, my question was, how much have we progressed from a question being asked in our discourse?
I think it's still being asked. Unfortunately, I think it's still being asked. And I think it will take probably at least another 10 to 20 years for that question to work its way through the system. I look at your generation, I say you guys are generation change. In some ways, you're going to be the ones that will find this very comfortable identity in the way that my generation did find a very comfortable British Asian identity. You know, we went through the yuppie-fied period of, you know, the Thatcher years, and you know, we got the big mobile phones and the shoulder pads and the legal careers, and we kind of thought we'd arrived. We were having foreign holidays, we were even buying classic cars. As British Asians, we'd kind of, that success that we had during that period meant that we felt like we'd arrived and we belonged. And I remember one of the things I talk about in this book is one of the things that my mum used to say when we were growing up would be, oh, we need to maintain a home somewhere in Islamabad because one of these days they, whoever they happen to be, are going to throw us out and we're going to have to go back. And I used to look at it and say, what are you on about? You know, why would you even come up with this crazy kind of suggestion of we're going to have to go? And after, I remember, post-Brexit, the first time in my 40s, after a 60-year history in Britain, worrying my mum's worry about where will things lead? Where will this go next? And I never thought I would ever think about that. And the third question that you asked me was about conservative branding. Do the Conservative Party actually want the Muslim vote? You're going to have to read the book. one of the things I talk about in this is, was the Conservative Party's policy making around British Muslims directly linked to an acknowledgement that that vote was irrelevant at the next election and possibly the election thereafter? And therefore, from a pure political perspective, they didn't matter. So if we actually annoyed them by lots of kind of awful policy making, did it really matter? And there was some quite detailed discussion and polling that went on about the communities who would vote for us. And I kind of unpick that in here. And I just say that naked political positioning actually leads to bad policy making in government.
Okay, now I promised those two hands which I saw first, and then I'll take this one here, and then we'll get to the others as well. So, yeah.
Hi, it's a pleasure to have you here on International Women's Day. Listening to your story, we feel as if there are still quite a lot of barriers that we have to overcome in the political world that the ethnic minorities are working. So in your point of view, what should the role of young generation be in order to challenge those obstacles, in order to challenge those problems that still
quite a lot of ethnic minorities are facing, so they can have their say, and not just in the political world, but outside in our society as a whole. So what should your point of views be on this question? Thank you so much.
Okay. I completely agree with everything you've said, and being from Luton myself, which has quite a high population of South Asian Muslims, I can understand a lot of the arguments you propose. But a lot of people always put a lot of responsibility on Muslim communities that they should be responsible for spotting the signs of extremism, which is quite an unrealistic expectation. It assumes they all know each other. But realistically, what do you think that moderate Muslims, say imams or church workers or even parents, can do to cull radicalisation?
Okay, and chap here. The microphone will head towards you, yes. And I think it's been recorded, so you get your name. Not in lights, in digital.
Hi, thanks for being here. My question's on racial segregation. So I'm from Blackburn myself, which is a town right at the centre of the heart of the racial segregation debate. My parents are from Ran Yorens in Dewsbury, two towns both categorised by a big divide in whites and Asians, predominantly Pakistan and Indians. So where do you believe the next step is in terms of joining the communities? My personal opinion is the segregation has come not maliciously. It's just evolved over time. It hasn't really been because two communities hate each other. It's just they live quite different lives, and unfortunately they had to separate. So if that is true, and that is your opinion also, how do we as communities join together, both whites and Asians, or where do you think it comes from? Do you think it comes from the top down, from government, from policymaking, or do you think it comes from local action?
Can I ask you just was your school segregated? I mean, did you find yourself at school?
I don't offend it anymore, but in our, especially our sixth form, where a lot of the, I went to school just outside of Blackburn, which is predominantly white, and a lot of people came from outside in Blackburn in, and the automatic segregation in the canteen where you had a place called Brown Town, which was part of the canteen, which was all Asian, and the rest of the canteen just was completely white. So it was evident then, but not because we hated each other, not because I was in the predominantly white area because of friends and whatnot, but it was just because we automatically sat down with who we liked, who we were friends with, and unfortunately it just led to a split down in school.
Okay.
So really quickly, because I know there's other
questions.
We'll
take one more range.
Young people role in politics. I mean, first of all, I think I think our generation has screwed up a little bit. So it is going to be left to your generation to try and get it right. And hopefully you're going to be confident global citizens where you're going to be much more open to lots of difference and won't define yourself in narrow ways in the way that's maybe, you know, lots of people in my generation started to do. What's your role in politics? Of course, look, there's barriers. There's barriers for women. We still don't have proper representation of women in politics. So black and Asian minority ethnic, yes, there's an additional barrier there. But what you do have is you have access to non-traditional means of campaigning and having your voice heard. And we've seen the power of that in recent years. So therefore, you do have levers at your disposal, which we probably didn't. And I would say to you that you've just got to keep going. You've just got to keep battling on these issues. There isn't a single answer, but I think it's about getting involved. Start by getting involved and then see where it goes. How do you spot the signs of terrorism was the question from the gentleman there. You've got to buy the book. I said I'd say that at least 10 times during the thing. But there's a section in here, which I won't be able to find very quickly, which says, if you could spot a jihadi, you could stop a jihadi. And I wish I had the night vision version goggles of spotting a jihadi. Because if I did, I could stop them. What I basically say is there are various telltale signs that we need to be looking for. But ultimately, the way you stop people wanting to destroy a society, there's a famous quote, isn't there, that when the young don't feel part of the village, they burn it down. You know, if you don't make people feel like they belong and matter in a society, then they will go and find a space where they do belong and matter. It's a basic human instinct to want to belong and matter. And that belonging and matter can come through race and identity, but it can also come through opportunity. If you feel like you've been to university, got a degree, but still can't get a job, it's always tougher for you to be able to get what you need to get. Then you are going to burn the village down because you kind of feel like there's something else. So I would say we have to consistently create policies and create an environment in which we consistently say to people, you belong and matter. If every day you pick up the Daily Mail and you're a young, you know, brown male, and you're constantly being told you don't belong, you don't matter, you're part of the problem, we don't want you here, then of course you're going to feel like, well, I don't belong and I don't matter, I need to go off and find somewhere else. So I think that's where it goes. It's not about, actually what's really interesting is, and I unpick this in the book, this is not about religion. If you actually look at the lives of terrorists, most of them lived fairly hedonistic. These are not men that went to the prayers five times a day. These are guys that used to like going out clubbing and enjoying their drink and drugs. The two guys who were from Birmingham who we picked up, who were on their way out to Syria to fight ISIS. You can imagine the conversation, can't you? Bro, let's go out to Syria. Really looks like really good fun. Got great cars. Might get a girlfriend, right? They head off, and then before they head off, they suddenly realise, oh my God, when I get out there, I'm supposed to be fighting a holy war, and I know nothing about this religion. They actually bought Islam for Dummies off Amazon. It was one of the pieces of evidence presented to the court because they didn't have a clue. The lack of religiosity and the lack of knowledge about faith is something that even people who've been held captive by Daesh come back and give evidence to say they didn't see any religious books. We never saw the Quran. We never saw any talk of religion. And I think it's a really interesting way that what we've done is we've focused in on this aspect of it without looking at the lives of these boys, mainly boys, and what they've done. I mean, if you look at, you know, the Nice bomber, if you look at what happened at the gay club in terms of the US where he bombed the gay club, one of the things that came out about him was that he was in a heterosexual relationship but had homosexual lovers. And that and there was this real confused sexuality and he was living this double life. So I think, again, what I'm saying is follow the evidence. See what the evidence is saying as to what the telltale signs are that we should be spotting. And then just put all your kids on Find Friends if you're parents, and then you know where they are at all times. The third bit is the question that you asked about segregation. Look, integration is a middle-class pastime, right? I don't have a problem with integration because, you know, we have houses in the nice part of town and we all have dinner parties and we've all got the same tea sets and we all ski in the same resorts and our kids go to the nice same schools. We don't have a problem with integration. Integration is an issue when you're at the bottom of the pile. Or integration is an issue not just because you choose to live in a place, but because you have no choice about where you live. And if you're living on a white estate and you can't get out of it, or you're living on a brown estate and you can't get out of it, or you're living in a community where, say, English isn't your first language and you want all your amenities around you, then integration is not going to be at the top of your pile unless it happens because you happen to live next door to each other. One of the things I talk about in this is my growing up in Savilltown, which is like heart of Dewsbury, where there's a very large Asian community. And when we were growing up, we had English neighbours on either side. And one of the neighbours was a family called the Good Lads. And I went back to the Good Lads when I wrote this book and I kind of talked about those childhood experiences and tried to kind of understand. And the Good Lads are one of the few families who still live in Savilltown. They're still there. And I said to them, look, what happened to all the white folk in Savilltown? And she said to me, you know, David, who the husband, he said, he's a builder. He said, I'd go out to work in the morning. There'd be one house up for sale. I'd come back. There'd be three. And he says, and this concept of white families. And I said, yeah, but why did they move out? And his wife, Veronica, says to me, you know what they used to say to me, Saida? They used to say, I can smell the curry through the chimney breast, and I don't like the smell of it, but we all like curry now. It was a reason that at that point, the point of difference was they have funny food and they have funny practices, and I don't want to live with them. And I think there hasn't been enough discussion about how much of the segregation is self-segregation and how much of that segregation is imposed because actually people moved out. I moved out. I did quite well. I moved into a nice white area. I had 6 months of egging to my front window and door and I had notes, three notes put through my letterbox about why have you moved in? We don't want your sort around here. So you either had to be successful to be able to move out into the nice areas, or you had to have a big backbone to say, I don't really care. You had to be brave enough to be able to say, I can stand and fight this fight if actually people come around and say they don't want me here. And you've got to have neighbours who are prepared to stay with you. And you've got to work in a way where actually you don't make the neighbours' lives hell so that they want to leave. So there's a whole series of things that need to happen on both sides. But ultimately, I would say, and it still comes down to this, that integration is a middle-class pastime. It's a luxury that people have when they've done all right in life.
Is that the mindset? On either side, it's mindset, isn't it?
Okay. Well, take that as a comment. Okay, you've got that one in. I'm taking one, two, three questions here. Okay. In fact, I'll take And you as well. All right, let's just sweep them all up here. All right, and you. Very quickly, he's got to be short and sharp. So very quickly, yeah.
Yeah, so just I'm from the same kind of background, from grew up in Wolverhampton, my parents were immigrants from India and everything else. But I'm just looking at this thing about evidence-based policy making, and I'm just going to make a kind of linkage with something that you just said about integration. The Cantle report, when the riots happened in Bradford and Oldham and all of that, and under Blair, and there's a big hoo-ha about it, about communities living parallel lives, and there's loads of initiatives and funding that was going on. How much of a positive effect do you think, from your own personal experiences, do you think that kind of evidence-based policy has had?
Okay. All right, I'm going to sweep round. Where was the next hand? It was possibly here. Oh, yes, you. Sorry, and then here. And then I'll come over there.
Hi, Saida. A big fan. Not politically, but big fan otherwise.
possibly one of yours.
Sorry, I had to make myself clear. I'm Northern.
I have my Labour sister over Labour here.
So you have Conservative and Labour. We're very plural here, I see.
It's a really quick question for you. We've got Syria, we've got the Rohingya Muslims, we've got the girls with Boko Haram. Not much has been done by our government. Is it a racism thing or is it an Islamophobia thing? And we also don't, we're not very good with welcoming refugees in this country, be children or adults. What's your thoughts on that?
Okay, great. And here, now I'm going to come over there. Yes, I'll come up and just sweep up there. So we have to do, can we have, where's the microphone? Sorry. We keep these as short as possible.
Apologies if you've been asked this question before. A lot of people traditionally view all religion, but perhaps Muslim religion a bit more, as being dominated by men or a bit oppressive to women. Would you say there's any truth in that? And if so, how does that synchronize with British culture and your life as a professional woman?
Okay. Great. These are all good questions. And gentlemen here, and then we'll go up.
Oh, hello. This question goes to the core of British identity, free speech. Is it possible to offer a robust critique of certain aspects of Islam without being deterred by the description of Islamophobia or an Islamophobe?
Again, and we're going to take... hands desperate. You can answer as many as you want. Go on.
Hi, just want to say that you're very inspiring, so thank you for having us today. Just, it's actually a twofold question, and it's just about the remarks that you made earlier about the terrorist profile and the actual role of religion. So do you think, just back to the government policies, do you think that anti-terrorism policies have put too much emphasis in religion, in the religious aspect, such as the training of imams, the funding of mosques, faith schools? And the second question: Is the government actually taken us away from the real problem, integration policies and tackling socio-economic discrimination against ethnic minorities, particularly Muslims in the UK?
Okay. I think we'd better pause the questioning there. Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
To you.
I'll try and get through the mindset. I completely agree with you. But much of that mindset is usually made from not having contact rather than from having contact. And so you find that the biggest pockets of kind of far-right activity are in places where you don't really have that many minority ethnic communities. How do you kind of change that mindset? Actually, by having an encounter. Refugees is a classic example. Most people will, you know, there's this narrative about we don't want refugees until they meet a refugee, hear that individual story, and then suddenly we're much more understanding of it. So the more human interaction and contact we can have, and the reason why I say integration is a middle-class pastime is because if you're doing all right in life, you've got more opportunities for interaction and on a social level than you are if you're actually just trying to pay the bills and keep going with two jobs. And therefore, it's not what, you know, whereas I would have lots of opportunities for integration, I can't imagine I would have had as many where I was brought up if it hadn't been for the fact that we lived next door to each other. And so therefore, unless there is living next door to each other, and because people have chosen to live in those communities, which London is far better at it than anywhere else, then I think it's going to have to be where do we have those social interactions. There's lots and lots of work that I've been involved in and others have been involved in about how do we create those spaces, you know, around music, around food, around children, lots of ways in which we can get to know each other. Evidence-based decision-making was a question around Cantle report. I don't agree with everything that Cantle said. I think some of what Cantle said, he didn't quite understand what was happening in terms of the provocation that was happening in some of those northern towns. And I log in here, the Salman Rushdie affair, the post-Salman Rushdie arrest, the post-Salman Rushdie riots, the early northern riots, 2001, before September the 11th, the Bradford riots, the Oldham riots, the Dewsbury riots. So I log a lot of that and say what was happening and what was not being recognised at the time. And there was this underlying kind of racial tension to that. Parallel lives, I think, kind of fits into that. Racism and Islamophobia, refugees, foreign policy. Oh, God, I could spend an hour talking to you about this. But what I would say to you is that foreign policy is basically the art of doing whatever we need to do to preserve our interests. And so, you know, one of the things that I found most difficult in foreign policy making was I would much rather the Foreign Office stood up and said, we don't really believe in human rights, we only believe in self-interest, and then we could just get on with it. But when we keep saying, oh, we really believe in human rights, but we never seem to actually follow any of it up, that's what I found really difficult. So the questions I used to say is, say what we believe and do what we say. Let's kind of be very clear about those questions. And if what we believe is actually it's about self-interest, which there's nothing wrong with that. I don't believe in that. I think it's a wrong position. But there's nothing wrong with, you know, other people believing that's what foreign policy is about. Let's just say that then. And I think that's where the kind of confusion arises, rather than it being racism and Islamophobia. It's just national interest. Islam and...
Well, religion and conservatism and men.
Islam and women. Somebody asked me about Islam and women.
Well, religion more generally. Yeah, conservative religion more generally, I think it was.
One of the things that I talk about in this, Madeleine Albright once says, every religious text has the ability to cause eternal war, and every religious text has the ability to cause eternal peace. Every religious text has the ability to be completely misogynistic, and every religious text has the ability to be a feminist. It's whether you're going to take that and interpret that and contextualize it in a way that works for you. I mean, there's a fantastic experiment which I'd like you to take if you get a chance called the Quran experiment. And it's two pranksters from the Netherlands who started it, where they took a copy of the Bible, covered it in a sleeve of the Quran, stood in the corner of town centers, and then read out various verses about women and gay people and various things. And people say, oh, well, yes, it's white, it's a uniquely violent religion and has no place in European society. And then they take the sleeve off and say, actually, it's the Bible. And people would get quite mortified about how they'd just assumed. And therefore, I think every religious text says some things which sound really weird in terms of women and lots of other communities. But it's about putting them into context. And I, as a feminist, as a Muslim, feel that there's no conflict between being a feminist and being a Muslim. I mean, I think if strong women like me who know their mind and are as outspoken feel that they can embrace and practice a faith as strong Christians can and strong Jewish women and strong Hindu women, I think part of the debate for us is to ensure that women continue to have a voice to interpret these great faiths and not leave it to the men to interpret it, which it has been for many hundreds of years amongst all faiths. And then the question that you asked, really important about free speech. First of all, Islam and religion. How much of it is to do with religiosity and how much should we be focusing on evidence? I mean, this is not my view. One of the things I do in the book is I cite all the evidence for this from, like I said, our intelligence services, the police, think tanks, academics, research, who go through all of this and look at what element of that was religion. It's usually the justification. Look, nobody's going to stand up and say, I want to be a bad boy, I want a big car, I want a big gun, I want to go around shooting people and have lots of women. Because I want to, because I'm a bad boy and I'm just a bit of an idiot, right? And I'm a moron. They're going to want to dress it up, aren't they, to say, oh, I'm fighting a holy war and I'm a really good person and I'm actually doing something good for society. It's just a justification that's used in the end. And I think it's really interesting how that's used. There's a really interesting documentary, if you get a chance to see it, by Peter Kaminsky called The State. And it's really interesting how it develops. I won't spoil it for you, but it kind of unpicks some of the issues around that. Free speech and Islam. I completely agree with you. The first thing, what I'd like you to do, actually, before I finish, is just, because I haven't read anything from a book, and it's relevant to this. Islam has had a long tradition of questioning and about challenging and about debate and about discussion. It's not absolute. It's never been absolute, which is why there are so many different ways to be a Muslim. It's never been absolute. And I have no issues with people saying, let's sit down and have a really interesting discussion academically or wherever about the role of women or the way in which different religions see gay communities or the role of capital punishment or corporal punishment. I have no issues with that. But I do have an issue with, you know, Pakistani Muslim men rape white girls. I do have an issue with one in five Muslims are sympathetic to jihadis. I do have an issue with that. So I don't believe the Mail and the Sun and Katie Hopkins and, you know, all the other people who want to write this stuff and say, all we're trying to do is have a debate about Islam. Well, no, I don't believe that. All you're trying to do is create bigotry and hatred in society because you're no intellectual, sensible people. The Archbishop of Canterbury sits down on a regular basis with his colleagues from the Muslim community and the Jewish community, and they have extensive debates about theological differences and the role of various religions and does a religion, and this is a debate that's been had amongst Christianity. It's, you know, what was it, 2014, we were still arguing about female bishops in this country. So every religion is on a journey consistently trying to find its space in the society in which it finds itself. I'd like to have that debate about Islam. It's a debate I have. I say to my kids all the time, don't follow anything in religion that doesn't make any sense to you. Don't just do it because somebody asked you to do it. You have to ask why. And if I can therefore finish on this, which is one of the things I wanted to do in the book was really talk about my faith. I always wanted to go into the theatre and, you know, mom kind of went, no, you're going to be a lawyer. And so I kind of thought, I want to do my soliloquy. This is my moment when I stand out on the middle of the stage and have my Shakespearean moment. So this was my soliloquy. I am a Muslim. I would describe myself as a pragmatic practitioner. I'm not content with simply doing religion. There has to be a why. For me, reason and religion go hand in hand. The lawyer in me needs to see the evidence and the politician in me needs to hear the argument. And it's why belief for me is not a stagnant position, it's a journey, not a destination, evolutionary, not revolutionary, and ultimately a source for daily reflection, self-evaluation at times of great success, and a source of strength at times of distress. My faith is about who I am, not about who you are. It's a rule book for me, not a forced lecture series for you. Its strength is a source of peace for me, not ammunition with which to fight you. It's a ruler I have chosen to measure myself against, not a stick with which to beat you. It allows me to question myself, not to judge you. And recognizing myself being sure of who I am, being comfortable in my identity, does not mean having to downgrade, erase, or reject who you are. Because I can only truly accept you for who you are if I am truly sure of who I am. Thank you.
That's an admirable moment to end. I was going to ask you, but I will on another occasion, to place Sadiq Khan's election as Mayor of London in a sort of broader political narrative. But we'll leave that for another occasion. All right.
I think my views on Sadiq Khan's election and Zach Goldsmith's campaign are on record.
Right, okay. Well, fair enough. I wasn't going to ask about Zach Goldsmith tonight. No nonsense, outspoken Yorkshire, I wrote down at one moment. And if anything were a sort of an example of what you might call traditional British culture, that's it, isn't it? So I'd just like on all your behalf to thank Saeed Abbasi for coming this evening to talk about her book. This was a Department of Government public lecture, I should have said. I didn't quite say that at the beginning. I would encourage you now to, if you wish to go and talk to Saeed and perhaps to buy a copy of the book. It's a book that you can buy outside.
Yeah.
Softback, so it'll be a bit cheaper.
Paperback's out now,
yeah,
so
it'll be a bit cheaper than
that
one. So thank you all for coming and see you all again soon, I hope.
Thank you. Thank you. It was brilliant. Questions.
Yeah, they were good.
Amazing questions. Short.